to be with you.
The rest of the department. It looks like the whole department here, which is great. I guess there may be one or two apologies. I don't see Ms. Benefold here. But that I will leave to the DG. Are we expecting more people? I just wanted you to all take note that with the new non-negotiables about being on time in school and teaching, the portfolio committee sat on time. It was the department that settled in 5 minutes late or took time to settle down. Okay. Mr. Indel, welcome to you. You want to just immediately just start with the presentation. What we will do, as you know, we are meeting over 2 days. So what we may very well have to do, having regard to your presentation, is during the question and answer session, we may have to split that up and focus on individual units and take that into tomorrow if we don't finish. And I'm sure we won't finish because I've got very enthusiastic members on my left who will leave no stone unturned in their quest to uncover all of the nastiness as well as the good things about the department. So over to you, sir. You want to begin by maybe introducing your team and doing whatever apologies you need to make?
Let me thank you, Chair, and good morning to yourself and to the honourable members of the two committees, the Committee on Basic Education as well as the Committee on Higher Education and Training, and thank you for this opportunity. Madam Chair, I can confirm that I think my full delegation was indeed waiting outside at the required time. We were asked to hold on until the committee was ready to receive us. So I would hope that we do continue with that pattern. Chair, yes, let me begin by introducing what you rightly say is a large team, and in part necessitated by the fact that we have had some changes within the department that have necessitated us bringing an additional number of people than we might otherwise have done. Perhaps one would note in the first instance the absence of one of our former DDGs, Ms. Penny Vingerfelt. She has, as of yesterday, assumed duty in the Western Cape Department of Education as head, so she will not be here, of course, today. You're welcome to quiz her in the legislature. The other DDG that we must apologize for is Mrs. Chubeka. She has some health reasons. She can't be here today, so apologies from Mrs. Chubeka. And I do understand that the DG of Higher Education Training has made arrangements. She is coming down, not today, but tomorrow, so she will be here certainly to deal with any queries or anything like that. Let me then turn to who I do have. It's Duncan Hindle, Director General of Education and Acting Director General of Basic Education. Please recognize that. Team I have together is, let me start with the DDGs, Ms. Kuhu-Dabeli on my right, DDG sitting behind me, I'm almost always cautious of that, Ms. Carlson, DDG in my office, and then at the DDG level also the Chief Executive Officer of Kadigudi, Professor Veronica Mackay, is with us today. And then I have Mr. Patel, who is in fact now seconded to the Department of Higher Education and Training to assist with transitional matters. He will ultimately determine where he goes in terms of basic or higher, but meantime he is seconded to that department to assist us in establishing that new department. I think those are the only fully fledged DDGs. Let me then turn to some of the others. My acting CFO, Mr. Trudeau, on my left. The acting DDG, who's taken Mr. Patel's position, Mr. Pagliacci, at the back, I'm sure they can wave. And Mr. Masui is acting DDG in Branch F, taking Ms. Vingerfelt's responsibility in that regard. Because Mrs. Chubeka is not here, she has asked for some of her chief directors to come down. We have Dr. Parker, who deals with human resources matters, sitting at the back. Dr. Satorley, all the doctors in this branch, I don't know. Dr. Satorley, who's with quality promotion matters, and Ms. Samuels, also chief director in that branch for curriculum and assessment. They'll provide the evidence of that. Let me note also Dr. Whittle, our head of communications, sitting at the back there as well, and Dr. Michalicheci as well, thank you, who's acting chief director responsible for strategic planning. Mr. Skuman is here, he's head of staffing, so he would deal with any queries on that regard. I think that's largely covered the team. Have I missed out anyone?
Come along.
I've mentioned Mrs. Goodman. All right. Can we leave it as all protocol observed, beyond that? Madam Chair, as you say, we do take this seriously, and it is a pleasure now to be able to report. This, of course, is the annual report of the former Department of Education, so it is a single report covering both basic, further, and higher education, and obviously future that will change now, but that's what we do in that regard. Chair, I've also just been given a note to say that the Deputy Minister will come into the meeting, if that's all right. I don't think he needs to say anything, but he'll be welcome to, I'm sure. The Minister, I understand, is in another meeting. She will try to come at some stage, if that's possible. I'm sure they would like to be here. And Madam Chair, perhaps just to say, besides the presentation, I do trust members do have the copy of the annual report, which we managed to complete just in time and got into Parliament by the due date. Madam Chair, let me then commence with the report, which is presented in two parts. The first deals with broadly the performance of the department in different areas, and we'll try and take you through that. And then a second part, very important, but perhaps not the only issue under discussion, obviously, the annual financial statements of the Department of Education. And let me start, Madam Chair, by, of course, reminding ourselves that we are dealing with what might be termed a rollover period. This, as I say, is the report of the Department of Education. So we are reflecting, in a sense, on a mandate of the previous administration. So when we talk, for example, about the minister's five broad priorities, we are, of course, talking about the former minister of education and the priorities that she determined for her term in office. So what we'll do is just look at those minister's five broad priorities. Those are, in many senses, the headline items that were noted and we'll report against. And then we'd go through each of the branches, just look at some of the areas of work that they've done. But once again, of course, to say that there is a lot more content in the annual report than we could ever hope to reflect here. So again, we would want to bring out perhaps some of the highlights of each of those branches. With your permission, Chair, let me then turn to the Minister's five broad priorities. And these, I don't think, should be any surprises. They have been for the period 2004 to 2009. These are the five big areas we've been working on, and many of them you will see reflected again in the individual branch reports. But let me just touch on some of them because they are critical. And the first one we acknowledged was the issue of dealing with poverty, and three headline programs, I think, that we've looked at around then. One, of course, is the broad issue of the cost of education, and our attempt to ensure that these costs do not in any way present a barrier to people attending school or even the school of their choice. So we've continued to work with that. But I think the most dramatic over that past period, and it reached a conclusion perhaps in the final year, was the declaration of no-fee schools. This was a major shift from where we had been before, and over the 5 years of this minister's period, we were able to move to this. I'll reflect a little bit on the numbers later on in the branch report, but that, I think, has been a critical move in the administration of education. Second big flagship program under dealing with poverty is the National School Nutrition Program. Again, we'll come to the figures later, but certainly internationally, this has been held up as a remarkably successful school feeding program. There's lots of work still to do on it, but I think it has helped to alleviate certainly some of the worst effects of poverty in education, and that's been critical. And then there are various other projects which we will talk about in the branch reports around the quality of teaching and learning with particular focus on disadvantaged communities and schools, and the main one there, of course, has been our Kids Up program, which the Minister at the time, Minister Pandor, continually referred to as our affirmative action program for poor schools. We'll come to the details of that. So that was a major part of our work, and some successes there, I think. The second broad priority was the whole area of skills development. And I think also if we reflect on the 5 years of that administration, probably the work we did around the FET colleges and skills development was some of the most profound. We had a very successful, I think, program of recapitalizing the FET colleges. Some nearly 2 billion rand went into these colleges, and anyone I think who's visited them recently will see that they are different institutions. So that has laid the platform for them now to offer modern, relevant, and updated programs. We've had a lot of work on teacher development, again, probably not as much as we would like and certainly not as much as the unions would have liked. We continue to work on this. One new development that has taken place around this, however, is the fact that now we are transferring funds directly to the unions themselves to work on issues of teacher development. And this has gone down exceptionally well with them, and I think we're going to see a lot of development in that regard in the future. Skills development around the teaching of maths and science, various initiatives there that will come up under the branch reports, but that has been noted. And again, to say we've seen some of the gains of that. The target that we set ourselves of 50,000 higher grade maths passes, you would know, was exceeded in 2008. We achieved, in fact, 63,000 higher grade maths passes. So certainly there is something happening in that regard, and that's very encouraging. Again, a huge success, I think, in this area on the math literacy campaign. It only got going in the last year or so of the administration, but it literally hit the ground running, and we will report later on the numbers that have been participating in that literacy program, both in terms of learners, but also in terms of the people recruited to teach, which has been a very good employment opportunity. Formal adult education and training programs continue. To a large extent, these are still basic education and training programs for adults, and there is a re-look at those. But we mustn't neglect, we have adult basic education and training centers around the country where various programs are offered, leading towards qualifications, leading towards the possibility, certainly, of people picking up a qualification and then re-entering the formal education system in some way. So we'll reflect on those. The work we've done with the university and the University of Technology, perhaps we'll report on those later, that I think the biggest shift that we noted there was a quite dramatic shift from broadly subsidy funding, general subsidy funding to institutions, that they just got an allocation and they used. During this last period, the last year or two, we were able to secure dedicated funds, which were then allocated to institutions, not as a general subsidy, but as a targeted allocation for particular areas, particularly engineering faculties, particularly in previously disadvantaged universities. Those are the areas we've tried to push resources into. And then the mandate we had to lead the process of developing a human resources development strategy for South Africa has been part of the work under skills development. I'll reflect on that later. The three others that the Minister asked us to focus on were quality improvement. And we identified there a number of areas, which I will touch on, early childhood development. All your international evidence tells you your best way of achieving quality is to make sure children get a good foundation. So the work we've done around early childhood development is critical. We'll come back to that. Inclusive education, trying to make sure that while those children that could be mainstreamed into public ordinary schools should be and have been, but retaining an emphasis also on the special schools, acknowledging that there are some children simply who do need dedicated facilities and understanding that. The Foundations for Learning campaign, a major one, and I'll report further, but this has changed, I think, in many ways, the terrain for teachers, particularly in the foundation phase. Welcome, Deputy Minister. The Foundation for Learning, as I say, changed the terrain, I think, significantly in this area, and perhaps almost prefigured this curriculum review that you would have heard about now, because to a large extent that's what it was about, giving very clear direction to teachers, to learners, to parents in the foundation phase, what they should be doing, how they should be doing, and what sort of targets they should be looking at. We've continued with our program of systemic evaluation. This is testing some 30,000 learners across the system to monitor quality. And then an ongoing work around our whole school evaluation. We have whole school evaluators appointed in every province who go out and look at the functionality of schools. We'll report on what they've been finding. Fourth priority was around health education. It sounds relatively small, but of course these are huge areas of work. The life skills program in particular, with a focus on HIV and AIDS prevention there, not exclusively, other issues of health and wellness also focused on, and we did produce a framework on health and wellness. One of the elements of that, of course, physical education as a regular activity at schools, very much part of that framework on health and wellness. And then finally, the fifth priority is around institutional development, looking at a number of areas. One is the districts themselves, getting them better organized and better able to deliver what they're supposed to be doing. The FET colleges, now we had recapitalized them to make sure that they were functioning properly. And then our higher education institutions, we had had some periods of closing around particular campuses, and it was trying to ensure that as institutions, these spaces were properly organized to do what they have. So just a little elaboration then on each of them, but mostly it's about the data. Firstly then, in terms of the dealing with poverty one, we are glad to say that 40% now in that year 2008-2009, 40% of primary and secondary schools in quintiles 1 and 2 were declared no-fee schools. This is after our consultation with the provincial department. But what people are not aware of is the fact that those 40% of schools, in fact, accommodated some 60% of our learners. So, in fact, some 60% of our 12 million learners at school are, in fact, in our no-fee. A lot of them, of course, are relatively small, so you get that kind of phenomenon, but that, I think, has made an enormous difference. We're now looking at taking the next step, and I think it'll be interesting to speak to the portfolio committees about where we go with these no-fee schools now and how we move them. On the National School Nutrition Program, that figure should be billion. It's an allocation of 1.5 billion, thank you, and that is growing and continues to grow. This year alone, it's over 2 billion, and by the third year of the MTF, we'll be touching nearly 4 billion rand per year. This 1.5 billion, we use it to feed approximately, there should be three noughts there as well. So it's 6,041,000 primary school learners, not 6,000, that would be a problem. So sorry about that. It's 6 million primary school learners in 17,899, nearly 18,000 schools out of our 27,000 schools. So, yeah, on a daily basis, some 6 million children being fed at school. I don't think we must underestimate the importance of that. It's very much in line with the way we're dealing with this, is to encourage local participation rather than driving past and dropping off a local tour of bread, trying to get communities involved. And we're very chuffed that in that year there were some over 6,000 vegetable gardens at schools which were being used to supplement the school feeding program. I think that number is continuing to grow and certainly very encouraging. And then, of course, we have continued in that year. We were asked to look at feeding secondary school learners. So from April this year, we weren't able to do it, in fact, in the 08-09 year. We didn't have funds available, but we prepared very well for the phasing in of school nutrition in quintile 1 secondary schools. That has commenced during the current financial year, and we are looking in the coming financial year to extend that even to quintile 2 secondary schools. Both the fee issue and the feeding issue are interesting. Many, many countries have taken options where they will make primary school free and they will put feeding schemes into primary schools. We're one of the few countries which has looked right across the spectrum and ensured that there's no fees also in secondary schools to make sure there's school feeding there. Poor children must also be allowed to progress through education in that sense. And then, as I say, the other areas around projects initiated to improve the quality of education, the Kids Up initiative has identified some 15,500 of the poorest schools in the country, and we've used the NIMS, that's the Education Infrastructure Management System, to pull out the data about those schools, and we have gone in with the Kids Up project to try and certainly facilitate the basic learning and teaching resources, photocopiers, games, toys, materials, whatever else it is those schools have needed, and we could give you a full report on what has been provided. provided to those schools. On the recapitalization and the skills development, the recapitalization of colleges, as I indicated, the $1.9 million for the recap, and then during the course of this year, we were given the $795 million, and that was around the implementation now of the new National Certificate Vocational Program that we were asking all the colleges to offer. This is a three-year program. It includes a lot of foundational skills, including communication and literacy, etc., as well as the technical skills that in the end are what the colleges are offering, and that's critical. In that year, was it 67 million or 670? I didn't think it was 670 million. Sorry, I should have done a quality control on this. It's 67 million for the bursary. Okay, an amount of $67 million awarded as bursary to 12,000 students in our ICT colleges, but that figure is certainly growing, and we will see the detail perhaps later. Sorry, I forgot to think about that. On teacher development, I think there's been some positive moves here. Firstly, of course, we've opened up the Swinzer-Lushaka bursary scheme, very attractive teacher bursary, far more attractive, certainly, than your NSFAS, for example. You don't have to repay them, you just have to work for the government. We're very encouraged in this first year of operation. We got more than 5,000 bursaries awarded using this 180 million rand. You can see the amount, some 35,000 rand. That doesn't just pay for your fees, it pays for your residence as well. It gives you some money for books and for food. It even gives you a little bit of pocket money change if you can. So we really are now in the case of really selecting the best. We completely oversubscribed on these bursaries, so we're able to really choose the students who have the right subject offerings in the first place, but more than that, show a very clear commitment to wanting to teach in South Africa, etc., and there's certainly a new cohort of teachers coming out of the system that I think we'll be very pleased with. So that has certainly taken off very well. Of those 5,000, remember that they were spaced over the 4 years of training. Just over 1,000 of them graduated in 2008, and they were placed at the beginning of 2009. So they've been put into schools and hopefully in places where they were needed most. Beyond that also, we registered some 2,000 teachers for a continuing teacher professional development program. 1,789 teachers registered for the National Professional Diploma in Education, that's the upgrading qualification, of which over 1,000 of them graduated in 2008. I'll talk a little bit more about teacher development later. We did reach the OSD agreement with teacher unions in April of that financial year. It still haunts us to a certain extent, and we're still picking up some of the details of that, but broadly we do have a new OSD approach to salaries for teachers that is being implemented in the system. And then finally on skills development, the maths and science focus, we increased the number of Dinalady schools to 500 during the course of 2008. We ourselves at the national level distributed LTSM books mostly and calculators and other things, some 12 million rands worth, went directly to Dinalady schools. And, of course, we did have the first National Curriculum Statement exams in 2008. Pleased to say that of the 63,000 math passes, some 55% of them were female, and 7% of them were produced from Dinalady schools. So certainly the focus approach is working, and also some of the work we're doing around gender and encouraging girls to stay in school and participate in these areas seems to be paying off as well. So boys had better watch out, certainly. Continuing with the skills development area, the math literacy campaign, Kariguni, it was launched in 2008, bearing in mind that we are committed as a country to meet the Millennium Development Goals, which is about halving illiteracy by 2014. We estimate some 9 million adults in this country are still illiterate, so our target there of 4.7 million is still only half of that target population. But obviously, if we can do that, it will make a huge difference. We have set ourselves a four-year period to 2012, given the funding constraints, it might have to be expanded up until 2014, but so be it. In 2008 alone, we had 380,000 learners enrolled against a target of 300,000. It's a very difficult one, this, because you get people banging on the door wanting literacy training. It's very difficult to say to them, sorry, we've only got a budget for 300,000 and you the 300,000 that won. We can't take you. We didn't take that approach. We allowed the additional enrollment, but at 380,000, I'm afraid, we had to call it quits for that year. Obviously, there are a whole lot more enrolled this year. The important part also, short-term employment was created for some 20,000 volunteer educators. They are paid a stipend beyond their normal travel costs even. So it is, in a way, a job creation for them. But besides the 20,000 who are actually delivering the literacy program, we had 200 supervisors, 160 coordinators, and some 2,300 full-time supervisors employed in the curriculum. So I think a huge success there. The enrollment at higher education institutions, I think we have reached capacity there. We've reached the target of 18% that was set for 2010, and whether we are able to now extend that, I think, will depend on the capacity of our institution. At the moment, it will be difficult, and this investment I mentioned earlier, the $439 million, was deliberately targeted there around infrastructure and facilities, particularly in disadvantaged HEIs, particularly around the areas of scarce skills. And I understand the universities have invested in these faculties, they have increased enrollments in these areas, and perhaps tomorrow the DG can fill you in on that one. And then, as I said earlier, also the human resource development strategy. It was published during the course of this financial year. There was a lot of discussion, both in NEDLAC and through the GIPSA structures, and finally, of course, it went to Cabinet. And this was approved early this year by Cabinet and has now become a guiding document for human resource development work across government and the private sector, of course. On quality improvement, I indicated earlier the importance of early childhood development, and I'm very glad to say that in the year under review, including the start of this year, we have 700,000 five-year-olds enrolled in grade R across the country. We are close to achieving our universal enrollment, which is our target, and we had hoped by 2010 to, in fact, achieve that. The target group could be up to 1 million, so there is still obviously some work we have to do to get the rest in. But I have no doubt that all of these 700,000 are going to benefit enormously from this grade R year that they have been able to benefit from. In addition, we've targeted some of the early grades, grade R and grade 1 learners, particularly in the Eastern Cape and Free State. Minister Panda was very strong about the importance of reading and launched this Drop All and Read campaign. And in terms of that campaign, we've distributed bags and reading books to a large number of grade 1 and grade R learners in these provinces. In addition, we've worked with USAID to produce books. They're known as the Otuba books. They were actually written by our local teachers. They've been written in all 11 languages, and we've been able to print 2.5 million of these books. Small little booklets, but very nice reading and very relevant stories for children, and they've gone to 2,000 of our most needy schools. So some emphasis there, certainly, on reading in the early years. Inclusive education is still, I think, an area that bugs us, and it's something that we have to continue to work on. We continue to monitor the implementation of inclusive education. We're trying to see what's happening there. One of the things we did discover was that, in particular around the assistive devices, the kind of tools and equipment that disabled learners might need, that provinces were struggling to procure that. So we have ourselves gone out on tender for that, and provinces can now buy the assistive devices off that tender. And we have been able, however, to address environmental access for 12 of our full-service schools. That means that there would be appropriate wheelchair ramps and that sort of thing in these full-service schools so that they are able to accommodate not just mainstream learners, but learners with special needs as well. But as I say, ongoing work needs to be done there. The Foundations for Learning campaign, as I say, a very dramatic change in what was happening there. Teachers now, under the Foundations for Learning campaign, being addressed directly for the first start, being addressed by the minister to say, this is what we expect you to do, dispelling any illusions about whether they should or shouldn't be teaching reading and literacy, but also sending important messages to parents to say, this is what your child should be able to do. When they come home at the end of term one, they should be able to read so many words fluently, that kind of thing. And I think it's really raised the benchmark around what is done in our foundation phase classes, very critical. And then just to solidify that in many ways, we've provided both the foundation and the intermediate phase in what we call assessment frameworks. So when they do go and assess the learners, they're doing it on the basis of a common framework. In many ways, this Foundations for Learning campaign, as I say, preempted the review of the curriculum we did. In a way, this is what teachers have been calling for, and we've now been able, I think, under the implementation review to expand on that. Systemic evaluation continues to be done. This is where we do a testing of some 30,000 learners across the system. It is gradually being overtaken by a national assessment, which is then not a sample at all. In fact, it's a full assessment of every grade 3, 6, and 9 learner in the system. But the systemic evaluation is also important because it gives you ideas of trends across the system. And let me say here that although obviously our results are still low at this stage and lower than we'd want them to be, when the OECD undertook the review of education in South Africa, they noted that the kind of increases we'd had over the two systemic evaluations we had done, which were increases in the region of some 20 to 25% of where we had been, the OECD itself commented that this was a significant improvement at a systemic level. So, as I say, we're certainly low, and we're lower than we want to be, but there's no doubt we're on the right track, we're improving. I think I'd just add here also, we do participate in what's known as the Southern and Eastern African Consortium for Monitoring Educational Quality. It's known as SACMEC. It's a regional initiative that looks at performance of learners across the region. And we've just concluded now the SACMEC 3 study, the third round of this SACMEC initiative. And I'm pleased to say also that although the data is still being finely refined now, there are indications again that we are improving our position relative to the region and also the performance of individual learners in that SACMEC. So, as I say, we're on the right track, but there's a long road still to work. Whole school evaluation is often forgotten about, and perhaps with the establishment of the Need You Now, it is something that will have to be reconsidered, but whole school evaluation remains a policy of the department. We do have whole school evaluators appointed in every province who go around and look at the schools, the 9 different areas identified. Those guides are then provided back to the school management team so they can see what it is they're doing right and doing wrong, and certainly that, I think, is assisting schools just to understand what it is they need to do and how they need to move. Finally, on the broad priorities, the health promotion, as I say, the life skills programs are compulsory in all schools now, of course, up to grade 12. That includes an HIV and AIDS prevention aspect, but many other aspects as well, and broadly about assisting learners to understand themselves and society. We continue to work with both learners, communities, and, of course, teachers who are affected by HIV and AIDS and other health challenges. We've got a nice program with the unions, for example, on a PCTA program for teachers, providing specific treatment for them. And then in the higher education sector, which is not unaffected by this, we have the HEAIDS initiative supported by the European Union, which provides support to higher education students as well. And then finally, on the institutional development, we have been able to construct some 21 new schools, high-quality school infrastructure facilities in 3 of the provinces. I think we need to comment here that this, in many ways, is a preferred approach, and it was Limpopo that perhaps took the lead here. Their line, I think, correctly was to say, we can continue to play catch-up on this infrastructure. We can continue to try and fix up this school, fix up that school, replace the one school here, fix up this, fix up that. And instead they said, why don't we just leapfrog to the front of the queue? Why don't we just go now and build some decent, proper schools that have libraries, laboratories, sports fields, everything else you need, and let's actually move in that direction. And you would have seen, I think, at the end of last year, Limpopo, or earlier this year, Limpopo opened their 3 state-of-the-art education facilities. And the idea there really to move children from these dilapidated schools, which very often take, in fact, more to try and fix and maintain, etc., and let's say let's move them into these state-of-the-art facilities. That seems to be a direction that provinces are going, which I think is useful. But we were also able to publish in November last year a government gazette, and this now prescribes infrastructure norms and standards. Of course, they can't be immediately applicable. We can't just declare in policy that every school will have a library. But what it does do is set the standards, and certainly we would expect that any new schools that are built are then built according to these norms and standards, and of course those that aren't there yet progressively to move towards those. But I think you've heard the Minister refer to the amounts that we would need to undertake and deal with all our infrastructure backlogs. District development is an ongoing body of work. We have a draft policy on the roles and responsibilities of districts. The Minister has referred it back to us to see how that fits into the bigger organisation of education, right from national to provincial to district to school. So it needs some refinement in that regard, but really it is targeted at saying, what do we understand about a district? What does it look like? How many schools does it cover? What sort of staff and resources does it need? And, of course, what are the obligations of that district? And I think we'd be happy to share that with you at some stage. I think it would be important for us all to know that. The FEG colleges all of them now have student support services in place. This is in fact a privately funded initiative, but all students there should be able to access these support services. We're trying to distribute as far as we can information about these bursaries available at FEG colleges, and we'd appeal to the honourable members to continue to assist us in that regard. Program documents themselves are publicly available, so people can see what these programs are, the NCB programs that we're offering. And we have finally been able to establish this National Register of Private FET Colleges. Very important. If someone is going to register at an FET college, please go first, check on the register, it's on the website, and make sure your institution is registered. Otherwise, regrettably, I'm afraid the exploitation happens. And higher education institutions, again, I think that's the discussion tomorrow. We've continued to try to support them in different ways, particularly with the regulatory support, academic research support, and also the governance issues that many universities are facing. So, Jen, sorry, I'll try and move a little bit quicker now, but those were some of the highlights. Thanks, Mr. Zell.
I wonder, if we shouldn't pause there, perhaps, have a bit of a general discussion on some of these priorities, although they feature later on in each of those administrative programs that you've got. It may be useful, I think, to try and do this. In any case, we've had this presentation with us as members for a while, so we would be able to speak, I think, fairly conversantly with some of the issues that you do raise.
Absolutely. I mean, your hands and the advantage I then have is with my team behind me, they might be able to deal with them more effectively than I. Thank you.
Exactly. I just feel there is a pressing question that a member has to ask, which is why I that's not true. I think let's try and do that, members. Mr. Boinamo, I'm going to give you the first opportunity to raise your question, which I told you to leave for now. But can we members just agree that we proceed to the first page, which is actually page 4? Sorry, Deputy Minister, I'm not sure. Forgive me. If you wanted to just say something at this stage, or will you also come into the discussion?
Thank you very much, Chair. Really to say that, show solidarity, to say that we certainly take to heart the hard work being done by the Portfolio Committee. We are available to provide any kind of support, and that really we should, given the time constraint, participate in the ordinary course, so we don't want any special space and time. The Minister would have been here, but she's presently in the meeting, and she will try to join the Portfolio Committee at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we do appreciate your presence. I did, just for clarity, say that if the Ministry didn't want to necessarily be here for this annual report session, that would be fine with me, given the split in the department and so on, and that this annual report is actually from the previous year. But we do very much always appreciate your presence.
The Minister, of course, was part of that previous administration and education.
I knew him in his capacity as the Minister of Justice. got Mr. Boinamo is going to ask the DG
It's difficult to follow the slides because some of the issues that we pick up would be on the report itself, so it would be difficult.
I'm saying that the report is taken as read because we've had the report for a while. So if you do want to raise issues that come from the BIA outside, but as long as it's on the scene, all I'm saying is that we deal with, for example, dealing with poverty. And we'll ask questions on dealing with poverty, which you can ask from the rest of the slides as well. That's not a problem.
Thank you, Chairperson. DG, according to the Auditor General's report, paragraph 2 under vacancies, it reads recent resignation of the current DG of the of department of the existing rather of the existing Department of Education raises concern about current situation in the Department of Education. Now, my question to you is, can you please furnish us with information surrounding the circumstances of your resignation? Thank you.
You respond, and I'm going to give you an opportunity to do that. Let me just affirm that Mr. Boinamo wasn't at the committee meeting because I think you're with higher education, not basic, and that the DG did, in fact, brief the portfolio committee. But I thought, given the nature of the proceedings today and that we're sitting with higher, it would be quite important for you to have contextualize that as well.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the opportunity and thanks to Mr. Bernong for the question. I haven't seen that Auditor General's report, so I'm not sure about that, and it concerns me a bit because I would hope that the Auditor General deals with solid facts and not speculation. And I have to say that the report that was in the media is in fact an incorrect report. It has been clarified by the department. The DG has not resigned at all. I remain Director General of Education. I remain the Acting Director General of Basic Education. That is the factual position, and anything to the contrary, I think the Auditor General must explain. But that is the position.
You did of course say so. You did say to us, though, that you will not be putting your name forward to fill the post of the Director General of Basic Education when that time arrives. Does that clarify things for you, Mr. Boynham?
Yes, it does.
Thank you very much. Auditor General clearly got it from the media. Oh, no, I wouldn't go that far, and I think it's a bit of an unfair comment. But let's leave it at that. I just wanted to make sure that you've got the answer that you were looking for. Okay? No, you can't. You put your hand up. I'll now accept hands for the poverty, the dealing with poverty priority. Ms. Moshwana, Ms. Mashishi. And then Mr. Boinamo, and then Ms. Kobai, and then Mr. Kotshan. Okay. Can we try and be as brief as possible so we cover as many questions as possible, okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Unfortunately, I'm always very brief. On Thank you very much. On the report given about Eastern Cape and Free State, receiving books. I just want to check what informed the decision to choose these two provinces out of the 9, or maybe the 3 most poor. And maybe on the next slide, I want to check on support into institutional structures. Free State and Eastern Cape, it's the minister's 5 growth priorities under that name. It says that bags and reading books were distributed to these particular provinces, and we just wanted to check the ration behind it, what it was here. And Now that then there are no kitchens, you know, for our feeding scheme. And kitchens could be built if the government can allow schools to build kitchens, because they cook outside, and sometimes when it rains, they cannot. And teachers, the principals have approached offices I know for a fact to say that would like to be allowed to build kitchens using the norms and standards. I'm checking if that can be changed, if there's a policy which says they must not build anything at all. Does that include kitchens? Thank you very much.
Okay, I then have Ms. Mashishi. Thank you, Chairperson. I have the DG on page 6 that he talked about the numeria project that he initiated to improve the quality of teaching and learning in disadvantaged communities. Maybe I'll be happy if maybe they break it, those projects, so that we know what kind of projects are they talking about. And secondly, they talk of the number 6,206 vegetable gardens that were tendered during the period under review. I just want to know whether this number covers all the provinces. Thank you very much.
Thank you. In brief, I've got Mr. Boynamani.
Thank you, Chairperson. DG, to what extent was recapitalization of 82 colleges a success? And secondly,
so what, sir?
Recapitalization of equity.
We're not there yet.
Or poverty. Okay. The school's nutrition scheme. We'll talk about the nutrition scheme. Has actually been a great failure or a challenge in some of the provinces. One of them being the Eastern Cape and KZN. Now the question here is, what plans are in place to try and improve on this, and also giving tenders to people who can be trusted, and the department itself paying people on time, the service providers on time, because this is a real challenge in this field. Thank you.
You got that question?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Bouchan.
Thank you, Chairperson, and to DG also for the report. My questions are on two issues here on page 6, that is the Northeast schools, and also on OSD is on the other. Now, DG, there has been a debate on this Northeast school policy, because schools that have been declared Northeast schools in the past, they wouldn't be able to run their schools on a day-to-day basis, because one, the money would come very late. Two, there was no top-up by the department to compensate those schools for the money that is no longer coming into their coffers. What is the status now? And two, the criteria for declaring these schools, the quintiles, different quintiles, have you now revised the criteria that have been used in the past, where, for instance, the school, just because it's next to a tarred road, it will be declared quintile 1 or quintile 2, whereas that school, when you come to the school, it is really very, very poor. I'm interested to know what criteria are you now using. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kubat. Covered, Ms. Dudley.
Yeah, my question was linked to Mr. Mponjani's question there about the Northeast schools, just in terms of the quality of education once there are no fees coming in. Is the funding matching what was coming in, and what are the sort of realities around this thing?
Okay. I don't know if you want to say something broadly first, on some of these questions.
So thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity. Obviously, the senior officials, managers of the department would be able to provide you with the details. The approach that we follow with regard to nutrition has not been a rigid one. In fact, there are many, many institutions, many schools that have kitchens within the premises. The preparation actually takes place within the school. So there has been no restriction. And the circumstances will determine which is the appropriate means of providing nutrition for the learners. In many instances, particularly in the rural areas, and I've seen that in the Free State, I've seen that in the Northwest Province and in Mpumalanga, preparations take place at home. In the school, women are drawn from the community to assist in the preparation, and great care is taken in relation to the training of those people who provide for the nutrition to ensure that the health standards, nutritional standards are complied with. So the department does more than that. And furthermore, that these allocations are as a result of a conditional grant that is being overseen by the department. I think what we can celebrate, really, Chair, is the fact that we've got more than 6,000 food gardens. And there are some wonderful, wonderful examples of application by the school and the community within around the school where people really take pride and care in terms of food gardens. It also basically is linked to the life skills program itself. With regard to the recapitalization, I think it's been extremely successful. About 1.9 billion over 3 years have been spent. It was driven nationally. There's been a huge improvement in the resources that are provided to FET colleges from the perspective of governance to equipment and machinery and the curriculum content that was redesigned in consultation with the various sectors. I think it's one of the programs that had been oversubscribed. From the first year, we had more learners than we had targeted. Second year beyond that, and the details are quite clear. Obviously, what the challenge that we face now is in the context of higher education and training, it would mean that the FET colleges must be looked at through a different lens in terms of your skills development program that is located within higher education and training. But what it does, it provides a good opportunity for a better articulation of education and training in those venues. Now, with regard to the tenders, Eastern Cape has, and I have the advantage of continuity and change in the sense that I've been there and I have not been there in education. Eastern Cape has been a problem. The National Department has indeed, I know in the previous administration, sent people to assist in the particular process, in the management of those resources. So while there were difficulties in some provinces, many provinces, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, have done extremely well in terms of that. But it's something that you've got to oversee, monitor at all times and support wherever appropriate. I think Mr. Patel would be able to deal because we've done quite a bit in terms of three areas, and I think that must be clarified. The way your quintiles function in the past has changed dramatically. Before, the weighting was more in terms of the physical location of the place of the school, its infrastructure, the affluence or otherwise of the surrounding community. Population, the learner population was not included in the assessment. It now forms an important feature of that particular area. One has to recognize the realities of migration. The schools that were previously occupied, as it were, populated by learners from affluent communities or middle-class communities have now changed dramatically. And this meant that the department had to look at changes with regard to how it funds those schools. So that's one element. The second element is that with regard to the quintiles itself, the norms have been changed because the procedure is that the provinces would provide a list of schools to the minister. The minister would then declare these schools as no-fee schools in the different quintiles. The proposed amendment now is that the MEC, provided he or she has adequate resources, could add to those quintiles. So where, for example, there's a dramatic change in the learner population and has a certain impact in terms of the ability of the school to be able to raise funds because it was at a quintile 4 or quintile 5, those changes can be brought about by the MEC, provided that it's not done irresponsibly, provided that there are resources that are allocated for that. But I think Mr. Patel would be able to deal with the funding. I think Ms. Dudley is indeed correct that one of the concerns that we had basically raised ourselves was the fact that is the funding adequate? You know, does it match what was basically being received? And we basically made significant changes there. What we can celebrate is that the allocations that a school receives per learner has increased significantly. In fact, the threshold is not less than 780. At one stage, it was as little as 240 and 250 in certain provinces. If you take a province like Mpumalanga or Limpopo, this has increased significantly. And the second, and I conclude on this one here, Chairperson, is that the monies are paid in tranches. So you don't have to wait for the new year. It's already in, I think it's September, so the first, May and November. So the monies are allocated to the schools in advance so that in November already you have money for the next year. The difficulty previously is that they would wait for the next year before the money comes through, in other words, end of financial year. That has been corrected and it's something that we are monitoring very, very closely. So there were difficulties, you're quite right, in the past, but these we have dealt with, and obviously you would from time to time come across schools that may have difficulties. We would be more than happy to receive any complaint or concern of where the system is not working so that we could immediately intervene in this regard. Chair, that's my contribution, but obviously the department is certainly in a better position to elaborate on it. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
We invite Mr. Nabeli maybe just to comment on any of the school units.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the DM has already indicated that we acknowledge the province in the Eastern Cape. And in fact, there was a team set up by the Premier's office, consisting of ourselves, the Premier's office, the Auditor General's office, that went to intervene in the Eastern Cape. We have seen, you will see in the report, a significant increase in expenditure. When we started, there was also a problem of the uncooked meals that they were feeding. They were only feeding bread. But we also see there's an increase in cooked meals. Clearly, we need to always be monitoring the process because there are still districts that are struggling. The KZN is actually quite different. It's one of our best-performing provinces. In KZN, they use two systems. They transfer money to schools, but also we have trained. We have 432 local women's cooperatives. It's one of the very few provinces that provide the funds to local women's cooperatives who then provide a different variety of means. So in that province, there is a much more better system of school nutrition. Again, with a problem as big as this one, there will be problems, but the province is quite alert to some of the challenges.
And you confirm the gardens in all provinces?
Yes, food gardens in all provinces. We are keen to make sure that all the schools that feed have food gardens, but sometimes the soil is not suitable, etc. But these are the government ones. They are school gardens that are sourced by other providers like Trees for Life, etc.
Thanks, Mr. Nabeli. Could I invite perhaps Samuel to refer to both the drop all and read, whether it is just the two provinces, and perhaps any breakdown of the Trees for Life program? Thanks, Mr. Nabeli.
Thanks, DG. The drop all and read has been operative for a number of years. In the 2007-08 year, the schools were chosen from the Northern Cape, Eastern Cape, Limpopo, as well as the Free State, but the target is actually the different nodal districts. A total of approximately 70 schools are chosen each year, and that is dependent on budget. In the 2008-09, it was the two targeted districts, one in Eastern Cape and one in Free State. For this financial year, the district that has been targeted is Obenjeni in KZN. Each learner receives a school bag, and the grade R learners receive a storybook and the grade 1 learners reading books. So each year, depending on the budget, we're working through the districts, the nodal districts.
Thanks, Nigeria. The KISA program is actually supporting the implementation of the curriculum by making sure that we provide, number one, key basic resource packages to schools to to improve on literacy and numeracy, where we know as a country we are underperforming. So this has been the priority for Kids Up. But in addition to that, we're providing some assistance to school management teams, your principals, so that they can be champions in terms of their schools improving, especially the primary schools, to take that achievement seriously. So that's been the second element of Kids Up. The third has been monitoring learner achievement, because it's saying as we provide assistance to these schools, we must make sure that we get benefit out of those resources that we provide to schools. So we've been looking at the outcomes. Are children in these schools performing better because we're providing support to those schools? So those have been the three major strengths of the program. Thanks, Chief.
Well, I'm sure we could come back and bring you a full report on that. It would be good. Madam Chair, just not to overdo this noble school issue, but perhaps just to make the little point, I think Mr. Bocciani's raised this issue before. You know, if you're going to have any system that affirms your poorest schools, there has to be some system of ranking. So I think that has to be the first starting point. You're starting with an approach that says we're going to favor poorer schools over richer schools. You need then some system that identifies who's poorer, who's richer, etc. So that's the basis, and you know, clearly if there are improvements we can make, we should do that. But the implications, of course, and I'm afraid people don't always understand this, if you're going to move a school down from a quintile 4 to become a quintile 3 school, then it means by definition that some other school has to move up from quintile 3 to quintile 4. And it's a bit of an irony. You've almost got schools now competing to be poorer than the other because your money gets better the poorer you are. Yeah? But in the end, people must understand it. So yes, everyone wants to be a quintile 3 school to get some more allocation, but if everyone is quintile 3, then we just have to drop the amount and we can't do that. Yeah? So we have to allow for some system. And broadly to say that in the end, the criteria that any school would apply, and certainly you start hitting it with your quintile 3 schools, is the allocation provided by the state going to be bigger than the amount we could have collected in school fees? If the answer is yes, then clearly the school is going to opt to become a no-fee school. But there have been one or two instances where the school has said, no, we think although support community, we think we can still get a little bit more out of the parents, so for us at this stage, we don't want to be declared. Well, that's fine. There's no obligation if the school has that capacity. Clearly, they must be allowed to do that. But let me also say, Chair, that recognition, of course, that the fact that now 60% of our schools effectively are no-fee schools, so effectively they're in one category, there is a process of re-looking at the national norms and standards for school funding, including the issue of quintiles. That's in the final processes of approval now before we begin with the consultation processes, and perhaps at that stage one would look at what new approaches can be done. I don't know, Mr. Padilla, if we need to add anything to that. You covered that. I think that then deals with those questions.
Okay.
The school qualifies as a quintile given the socioeconomic conditions within which the school is established. Not because the principal or the teachers want to continue to collect the school fees, because how would they then collect the school fees from Western poor parents who cannot be milk fed? Can you explain that?
I don't know that they're going to explain that. But what I will suggest is, given the new information that the Deputy Minister has given us about the progression, for example, in terms of the amount that is funded per student and so on, and that increase and so on, could we not just get I want to say a briefing document, but actually a full explanation of how the system works with all of these changes. In other words, factor in the MECs, the new powers, and so on. But link that also to the issue of the budget that was spoken about. In other words, if if National is able to declare certain schools no-fee schools, where does the budget come from? Likewise, if the MEC is going to be given that space as well, where would that? What is the understanding? What's the protocol? Would you be able to do that for us, Mr. Patel? Okay. All right. Yes, Mr.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a question. Is the classification of schools into Section 20 and 21 connected in any way with the quintile system, or is it different?
different system altogether.
There's no legal correlation. Either school, no fee or fee, could be a Section 20 or a Section 20. But I'm sure Chair would be happy. Partly Mr. Padiachi would not take that responsibility, but I'm sure Mr. Patel would work with some time.
That's on nutrition. In the past, we've asked the question because in some areas there's this tension between principals of schools and the service providers, because in some instances, principals have formed front companies to provide services for this nutrition. Has the department done any, what you call, investigation into that allegation of principals forming front companies?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I know in the Eastern Cape that was done. So in the Eastern Cape, I know that that investigation was part of the broader investigation by the Premier's office. But every time the matter is raised, the department jointly with the province do investigate the matter.
The obvious question is whether Mr. Mpochani has in fact reported this to the provincial department. Have you reported these incidents to the provincial department so they can be investigated? I must appeal to you.
The information comes to them, there is an investigation that is lodged into those allegations. The problem is when they don't get the information. So if you do have information of certain specific instances, that should be reported. That's really where. Okay. You might want to, Ms. Ndebele, just give us a report then of the outcomes of those investigations per province, and the extent to which you found wrongdoing, okay? All right. We're going to now move on to skills development. I've got Mr. Makubela. Let me just give you all numbers. One is Mr. Makubela. I'm going to go 2, 3, 4, 5 in that order. 1, 2, you are 2, Ms. Fortune. You can't put up your hand again after I've like passed you. Then you become number 6 again. Okay. So very basic. Basic education. 1, then you are number 2. Okay, now you've been relegated. It's Mr. Marco. Okay, it's 1, 2. I've got 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay?
Okay, thanks, Chair. The first that I've got in terms of the elaborated sections, it's under teacher development on OSD. And my question really is that I know, or it's common knowledge, that there were issues around the OSD. I'm just checking whether, in terms of the budgeted amount, was there any money paid, say, during the 08-09 financial year, or that money is going to be paid during 09-10 financial year, because the agreement was said to be in April or in 2008, and whether there's been any particular payments in terms of the budget. The other issue that I have shared was going to relate to universities. But in there, it relates to NSFAS, NASFA. Understanding that there's some money that was allocated very late or received by institutions of higher learning very late, meant for the graduates for 2008. Or the money missed the target because it was targeted for them and it was never allocated to them. By the time the money arrived, they were out of the system. And what the department is going to be doing in terms of that, was the money by now
maybe with institutions, but it can be accounted for necessarily in terms of the targeted group that it was supposed to have gone to. The very last, perhaps, is the supervisors and coordinators who are responsible for Caribou and so on, complain each time that they don't receive their stipends regularly or consistently as in month to month, whether the efficiency of the system is able to deal with that or have continued inconsistencies in that particular regard. Thanks.
I admire the devotion of the Department of Education to doing the work that you do in the face of quite a lot of considerable challenges, not least of which is the increasing insistence on the part of those who run our finance divisions to extract greater rewards from the investment placed in education. So I know I was once an advisor to Kara Asmal as Minister of Education, so I know how hard it is. So thank you very much. It's recognized and it's appreciated. I had a question about universities of technology, and I must say a great concern about the fact that they are in many ways an aspiration in terms of becoming universities of technology, because technology universities or institutes must rest on a pretty solid science base in order to be those, and our universities of technology are quite uneven on that, in that regard. And my question is really whether there is a plan to insist that universities of technology actually offer basic science courses. I'll just give you an example. The Cape Peninsula University of Technology does not offer biology. If you don't offer biology, you cannot have biotechnology. And it means you cannot deal with the biotechnology of extracting, for example, chemical compounds from plants in the Western Cape. So I think that a university of technology must have as basics courses in chemistry, biology, physics, mathematics, and engineering. And anything on top of that is a nice addition. So my question is there such a plan to, in fact, incentivize University of Technology to go in that direction?
Thank you, Chair. My question is about the inclusion of FET colleges into the higher education and training category. I still don't really understand the reasons for that, because in my opinion, I might be wrong, the bulk of the learners in that category really haven't gone beyond metric. I might be wrong. Maybe I'm old-fashioned and far behind with statistics, but in my opinion, to be in that category, really, you must have really gone far higher than just standards. Grade 9 and grade 10, because obviously if you want to go into the technical studies, I think the bulk of people in the technical studies are in that category of grade 9, 10 and so on, who perhaps find it difficult to go to metric and they branch off and go to FET colleges. So you will correct me if perhaps my understanding is wrong, but personally this is mind-boggling. I don't understand why these people should now, you know. This reminds me of something that happened not very long ago, where FET colleges would have graduation ceremonies wearing gowns and hoods and so on, instead of really, I mean, technically, personally, it doesn't make sense to me for people to be doing that when you know your job has to do with overalls and now you emulate these other people. It's like there is an element of inferiority complex in this thing. So now once you take these people and you now lump them together with universities, you are reinforcing this idea that to be in technical education, you are in an inferior category. You need to have gowns and hoods and so on. That's just a comment. But my question is about what are the reasons for including this group into higher education and training? Because to me, it's like you will have even the grade 9 and 10 in that category. Thank you. But now you make me fear to ask the last one. I can prove it, that I'll be very brief. The last one will be very brief. It is linked to what he said about the universities of technology. And but this is about, you know, the historically disadvantaged universities. It might be technology or ordinary universities. I don't understand why at this stage in our history, we still do not have, you know, studies like engineering. Although I saw in the presentation something about it here, the, you know, engineering faculties and medicine. I had hoped that at this stage, in all the disadvantaged universities, we will have these studies. But it's like we are taking it very slowly. I don't know. It might be human resource problem or maybe budgeting problem. I don't know. Perhaps I could get a comment on that one. Thank you. I've been
pretty enough. You mustn't try and answer me. All right. The next person is, I think, Ms. Dudley.
Thanks. My question is around the comment that we would now be giving money straight to unions for teacher development. And that sort of just, for me, it sort of questions around who decides what training is going to be given and where's the monitoring going to be, and would there be some kind of discrimination then if you're not in particular unions or you don't choose to be in. But it's a lot of those kind of questions, and I'm just wondering how well thought through these are and where we are, where we at the moment on that. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think all my questions have been asked, but for that one of the curriculum and the OSD. But I'll just add to what the latter speaker have just spoken on that one of the funds for union. My question is, how are we going to do the distribution? The distribution is going to be done according to the membership or what? Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, thank you. I'm just looking at the improving the stream of mathematics and science. And when I see most of the initiatives that the department is coming up with, like the support material that you chair just prepared, those that make the newspapers, the television sets, the physical targeting with the matriculants, taking the second chance program. I'm just wondering, just to say, do we exactly see these things benefiting almost all the matriculants that used to be distributed to benefit? Because I'm just thinking of deep rural areas, maybe like where I'm coming from, where it's even difficult to get even a newspaper, a copy of a newspaper. Are we not discriminating a little bit to say those who are advantaged, they will get such assistance and such support, and really they are schools of education, they can't even get hold of these supplements that you are giving them? What is it that you are doing with those such kind of schools in those different areas? And around a Karigud, Chairperson, there is this, I don't know whether it has ever reached the department, as the complaint around the time that is allocated for such programs, quite a big program, but the 6 months sometimes is a little bit short. What have we ever considered maybe of extending it to a year, at least 12 months, where you can feel that an adult who has been for the first time to hold a pen and a paper, at least within that 12-month period, it can be much better than the 6-month period. I understand it's
I'm covered with Comrade Douglas' question, except to ask the department, when allocating the money to the unions, has the department really thought this through? Because to me, these unions, teacher unions, are more on political radicalism than on professional ones. Just look what happened recently during the exams. Many teachers boycotted what was otherwise a good initiative where SADU decided to help the matrics catch up their classes. But a foreign donor had given money to SADU. Now, instead of promoting, helping them, they were using this for political purposes. And I'm just wondering whether the transit has thought about this rule.
No way, you got all that information.
I'm constituency based.
Chair, thank you. Rather, some difficult questions. Let me say that perhaps some of the higher ed stuff, particularly that regards your plans for the future, I think might be better discussed tomorrow. So perhaps some of those we'd prefer. Let me just deal perhaps with this hot one of the money to unions. Let me firstly make it clear, this is not the totality. It's a very small slice, in fact, of the money available for continuing professional development that is channeled by the union. Let me make it clear, it's all unions that are eligible. They do it according to business plans and strict reports in terms of that process. And then the question was asked about who monitors it. Well, the whole area of CPTD is governed by your South African Council of Educators that then allocates professional development points to different programs, so all of it would take place under that framework. But certainly there's no doubt unions, and internationally it is the case, are very good very often at soliciting from the ground what the needs of teachers are, and in a way they are able to deliver those programs sometimes more effectively than the department. I can also say that we're looking at doing much the same with our school governing bodies, that we find ways that allow the school governing bodies themselves to be supported by government, provides the very training that is needed by school governing bodies. So that, I think, is an acceptable model, but let me say quite clearly, it's not any particular union, it's everyone that is eligible, and in fact, I should indicate it's NAPTOSA and the South African Onderwys Union who have been the first two beneficiaries of this funding. Chair, just on some of the others, firstly on the OSD, the agreement that was signed in March and April this year, the original OSD agreement was fully funded, and all of those funds have indeed been paid out. So OSD for teachers is being implemented, has been implemented, and that funding is continuing. What we're dealing with now, and that perhaps you're picking up, was some of the additional items that weren't covered in that agreement, which are now the subject of negotiations with teachers. So when there's talk now about teachers' OSD, these are in fact what we're calling OSD 2. It's the second round of OSD issues for teachers, and you know, as I say, those are still under negotiations in part.
I do think that there's quite a lot of very confusing and conflicting information during the round on precisely what the agreement is, and sometimes more importantly, what it isn't. Could you give us just a short report on what it is?
Mr. Patel is the lead negotiator, so I'm sure he can correct me. But broadly, OSD, of course, is part of the broader government initiative to try and establish separate salary dispensations for particular occupations. So teachers, engineers, doctors, whoever else it might be, each of them, instead of having a common public service platform for salary, you would now have occupation-specific dispensations. And broadly, the agreement that we signed with the unions earlier this year was to shift now teachers from the current public service salary scale into a new set of salary scales which would be applicable only to educators. And linked to that were a whole lot of provisions in terms of how you move up those scales, how quickly you move up those scales. There was a performance element to be built into it that you could in fact leapfrog certain scales. So all of those were particular provisions around how teachers would be appointed onto different levels and then remunerated at those different levels. And as I say, that agreement was signed and has been implemented fully. Teachers have been transferred to the new scales. So certainly you won't find a teacher now who can be compared to another, you know, official in another profession in public service. They have their own dedicated salary scale. And as I say, there were a couple of areas that were not covered in that original agreement, which now have become the subject of new bargaining, and we have signed an agreement on that, that effectively is an agreement that says, in principle, we support what has been proposed by the union, but we had to indicate that the funding did not allow for full implementation, so that is the ongoing process with the unions now to look at the implementation dates for those outstanding elements. But on the OSD itself, effectively, that's all it is. Mr. Patel, is there more? Is it covered? Thank you. So that's what it is. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just say that the OSD 1, as the DG says, was actually signed in March of 2008, and all those particular funds were paid out. What it meant was that there were new OSD scales, and people were translated onto the new scales with effect of 1 January 2008. What it meant was it was a 5.5% average increase, because there was a minimum 4% on translation to the new scale. The translations then ranged between 4 to 9%. In terms of then that particular agreement, the annual progressions, for example, the 1% annual progressions was done away with, and that teachers would have qualified in this particular, in 2010, for 3%. Increments every 2 years, and those other favorable conditions in terms of accelerated progression. So I'm not too sure if that answers the question, but in last year, they received somewhere around July, backdated to 1st January 2008, their translations to the new scales. So they were on the new scales. Thank you. The starting salary moved from 99,000 to 115,000.
Can I do this? Can I ask Mr. Patel that you put this down for us in a report, because it is rather difficult to absorb and analyze just on an oral briefing. And then maybe what we will do at some stage is to call the department and delve deeper into exactly what the package for an average teacher would be. Given that you've got these multi-year agreements now, that clearly would help us understand.
We'd like to do that, and I think to factor in, though, also the general salary agreement. You know, the Secretary President the other day was on record as acknowledging that over the last 3 years, teachers have had salary increases of nearly 40%. Add to that now the general salary increase this year, which is in excess of 10%, plus, of course, anything they might get out of OSD 2. I think we've certainly seen an improvement in conditions of service. We'll argue about whether adequate or not, but they certainly acknowledge a dramatic improvement over the past few years.
In that report, if you could give us that progression from, let's say, 5 years ago to currently where we stand.
Yes, how would this interpret the fact that today, for instance, in the media, in KZN, teachers are threatening to disrupt examinations over OST. What is it in different provinces?
This is OST 2, Chair, that they're looking at, and we have written to the unions, and the LRC has also put out a statement. These payments could not be made in the month of October, because Purcell was at that stage busy implementing the general salary increase for all public service, which included teachers, of course. So they would have got an increase in October, backdated to 1 July, the general salary adjustment. We have committed that in November, the OSD payments that have been agreed to will be paid out as well. They're all backdated to the 1st of July, so there's no question of anyone losing out by not being paid in a particular month, and I think it would be rather nice for teachers at the end of November. They'll get a nice little Christmas bonus in their packages. So I think these teachers are out of order. Certainly the national leadership of all the unions has accepted the payment dates, and there shouldn't be a problem with that. Jeff, shall I carry on then? Okay. On the NS51, certainly we're not aware of any late allocations, and again, I would have to appeal that if members are aware of any student who's been prejudiced or an institution that is not paying out these amounts, the system, the way it works is that the universities give the bursaries or loans to students. They then claim that back from NS Fund. There is no reason for NS Fund to be withholding that money. They get their money on 1 April of each year when it's allocated. So please, I think if you're aware of these kind of things, let us know. But perhaps I'd also ask the DG of Higher Education to have to talk a little bit more about NS Fund tomorrow and on what she's doing. And really, Honourable James, I'd like to allow her as well to talk to the issue of the University of Technology, the plans, etc. Those are really issues going forward rather than annual report, and I think she'd be best placed to deal with those. On the issue of the FET colleges, firstly to understand, it's not a higher education ministry, it's a ministry of higher education and training, so it covers the whole gamut of higher ed as well as skills development, and I think colleges are very much part of that skills development. You are right, of course, you can enter an FET college after grade 9 at school, but let me also say that we are very consciously favouring rather learners who have completed matric before they go to FET. Evidence already is showing that those learners are much more successful, both academically, but as you say rightly, socially also. College is a different environment, and you know, people need to be self-motivated there, etc. So we're certainly preferring post-matric students, and of course that's why we are investing at the moment in the recapitalization now of your technical high schools, so that that grade 9 learner who's not maybe academically inclined stays in school, but at a technical high school, before perhaps completing and then going on to a college or something like that. So it is there. Let me just say, though, that in terms of the transfer of the colleges, et cetera, there's been a little bit of instability. Colleges perhaps not sure what's happening. I think Treasury have made a very good decision. They've said for 2010 now, all that they're going to do is take the money that would have been allocated to colleges through the provinces. They're going to top slice that, bring it to the national, and the national will then run it as a conditional grant. That is a big advantage, obviously, of ring-fencing that money because it can't be used for anything else and basically ensuring that it gets down to the colleges where it has to be. So at this stage, they remain provincial functions, they remain the responsibility of provinces, but they'll be funded through a conditional grant. If there had to be a change to that, clearly there'd have to be legislation and whatever else gets dealt with there. The HDI issue, again, I think higher education will have to talk to that. Benefits of these interventions, particularly in rural areas. Let me say firstly, the newspaper supplements were not just produced as supplements to newspapers. They were sent out directly to district offices, etc. And hopefully all schools, wherever they might have been, should have had access to those. The TV support was also not multi-choice. It was SABC, and I hope that SABC has got that kind of footprint around the country that everyone is able to reach it. The value of this cannot be underestimated. It's useful, obviously, for those children who are doing matric for the first time, but one thing the Second Chance program showed us was how effective just this little bit of support can be. You know, of the learners that wrote the Second Chance, now bear in mind, these were learners who had failed matric. They couldn't go back to school because the curriculum changed, so they got a second chance to write. We gave them these little bit of newspaper supplements. We gave them this little bit of TV teaching and whatever at these TV centres that we sent up. And many of those students, in fact, they passed their matric. In fact, in some areas, more of them passed than had actually passed when they were attending school itself. Now, that's a very serious indictment on the schools, and we need to look into that. But it does show that with just that little bit of support and good teaching through television, you actually get this cohort who were seen as failures actually being able to pass. So we realize if we can do that for them, surely we must make it available to our first-time matrix as well, and that's gone there. Let me perhaps just remind you, and I hope it will be the last time, if you're aware of a school that doesn't have the study mate, please, we've got a call center. You don't have to call the presidential call center and hang on for however long. We've got a call center in the department that is answered properly. I hope you've all got the number, 0800 20 29 33. Phone us within 48 hours. We will get those study mates and whatever else have to get to that school. 0800 20 29 33. We'll test you on that next time. Yeah? But please make use of it. You are the public representative. Get hold of us. Just say, this school doesn't have, we will turn it around and we will get there as well. Yeah? Let me now turn, if I can, to Professor Mackay and
give the Deputy Minister an opportunity. If he has to leave, and then we'll continue with the rest of the team.
So thank you very much. I'm most impressed with our DGCR abilities, and I think excellent DG. I'm very proud. The DG has really covered the response to Mr. Khaniyako, but just to say to him that I think he should understand the environment. Firstly, it's not a school. The SET colleges have been recapitalized, and new legislation has been passed to provide for flexibility. People tend to confuse the NCV, the vocational courses, as the only thing that is being offered there. There are artisanal skills and intermediate skills. So you have a choice of doing a range of programs for levels 2 to 4 currently, and you can also do short courses. The artisanal skills that you're talking about, bricklaying, fitting and turning, etc. So what this does is provide the flexibility that is necessary. Another difference in the FET arena right now, environment, which would help the articulation of education and training quite significantly, is it's not a school in the traditional sense. They are not employees of the department. They're employed by a governing body, a council that has been established in terms of legislation. The hours are flexible. The programs are flexible. You could do a range of things. For example, if you want to train your nurses there in the FET colleges, you could do so. If you want to improve training of your educators, you could do so in the FET college. So it provides that huge space and opportunity for training and skills development. And I think one must look at the FET colleges from that lens, but obviously the Director General from Higher Education will be here tomorrow and probably be able to say what their plans and vision are. The last element perhaps is to take into account that your seaters would also form part, would also be moved, migrating to the Ministry of Higher Education and Training. So it's precisely what the DG has said. It's not only about education, it's about education and training. And perhaps before I leave to say, Dr. Wilmot's point is, it's an old debate that was going on, and you probably are aware, having been in the department, with the Department of Education, the contestation between universities of technology and universities, the one wants to emulate the other, and we've always been arguing for a distinctiveness and for the ability for universities of technology to basically to be responsive to the innovative demands of business, and therefore the partnerships between business and universities of technology certainly are critical. I cannot but agree with the fact that the scientific basis of universities of technology in its broadest possible way is quite critical and necessary for human resource development in the country. Chairperson, I'm sorry I would have to leave you now, but I'm more than impressed with our very capable team over here, and then if the portfolio committee could excuse me and wish you well in your further deliberations. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Chairperson, just before that. Deputy Minister, just before that, I would have raised it earlier. That's fine. It was just a slip off the chairperson in terms of seeing the end. It's fine. The issue of on higher education and training, I think it's right in terms of what FET is and so on, and that's the future. I think there is an important not necessarily skilling, but a focus to be given through the teacher development intervention around the perceptions of teachers and schools when it comes to FETs. So the jury, I think, will still be open on, is it because grade 10 and 11 is not strong enough and therefore it's better to after matric then to go into FET, or the mass number of people that's been directed from schools to FETs is, please, I don't want to deal with you because you're actually the problem child, go to the FET. So I think there is a big issue there, and my advice would be that whilst higher education and training then will be focusing on that, if we can actually ask basic education just to look into that matter around that perceptional analysis. And there's studies being done on that, but I think it's already, even if it's a sample of an analysis, I think there's general assessment that that is a problem. And if we are able then to massify a strategy in that space, that's just something that I thought of asking you to actually focus on, because it is going to be important.
May I just respond to it very, very briefly? It's precisely, thank you, Francois, because what we had done, in fact, my colleague, the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs, and I had visited 9 provinces to really promote FET colleges and to clarify the misunderstanding. I think it has contributed in a great measure to the huge enrollment that we've had there. The curriculum design has been changed significantly. What you have in an FET college, for example, is a complete immersion of ICT in the curriculum, whether you're doing electrical engineering, plumbing, or whatever else. So that is new, but it's responsive to the particular area. So particular attention has been paid. But I think what the DG has said is something very significant, that we must recognize that basic education is for schooling, and that we've got to deal with scholars. And those that the technical aspects of schooling would be dealt with in the recapitalization and expansion of our technical schools. We are identifying schools in the 9 provinces as we speak right now for that expansion program to take place. So our schools would not be competitors with your FET colleges. Our FET colleges would rather be avenues of skills development of a great variety and so on. So even those learners who are not in school, because of our commitment to continuous education, who want to do a program, they may be 30 years of age, may want to go to an FET college to say, look, well, how can I enhance my skills and my ability in that particular environment? So that creates an alternative which we don't really have, but we certainly would pay careful attention to the concerns that you've raised, and thank you very much for that. Chair,
let me just leave you with this thought, because this is one of the things that I said to the department when we engaged with them in Pretoria. But as much as my fellow colleague chairperson is alluding to is quite correct, what we need to bear in mind is that in that transition, because there is this transition, we can't have a situation where people who are left without options because they are not academically inclined to schools and cannot go further than grade 9, for example, or grade 8, and who need the option of a technical school when, as much as we are funding those schools and you're recapitalizing and so on, at this stage, there aren't many options available to them. And FET is are now taking a very hard line in terms of their admission criteria as well, where they will not accept students who have not passed a certain grade, I think it's grade 9, subject to correction. And you're then left with a whole cohort of young people who have no options, and that's for me the critical issue in this transitional period, that we have to, both basic and higher, have to synergize on that, because you can't close doors to people simply because you're in a transition. I am so eating my hat on this issue. I don't know if you want to raise anything else, Mr. Fassman, before I continue. Next time, don't raise your hand. Just stand up. Okay. You were still trying to farm out some of those questions.
Yes, I was going to invite Professor Mackay, but absolutely, I think what the Deputy Minister said is right. We've got to find ways that the schooling system is able to absorb all those surges and provide them with the opportunities they need. So that's great. Professor Mackay runs the Karakuri program. There were 2 issues around the payments and the length of time.
Thank you. Yes, we do have a lot of complaints, Honourable Member, from coordinators and supervisors who feel they're not yet receiving their money on time. And I need to explain some background to this so that we understand what the delays actually are. We try to stress to the volunteers that they're not employed and they're not paid on the Purcell system, but that they're paid a stipend, and the stipend is paid in terms of particular outcomes. Because of the high numbers of volunteers that we have, and this year we have 40,000 volunteers, and we see this money as part of a kind of social grant for them, the amount of money, when we handle the large amounts of money, we have to handle the system extremely tightly. Otherwise, you would be asking other audit-type questions of me. We have to avoid any possibilities of ghosts or of people not doing their work on the ground and claiming foreclosures taught. So we've had to develop a tight system, a system which has been checked by the Auditor General and by National Treasury. And that system enables us to pay out this year 325 million rand to 40,000 people within a period of 6 months. We are now on pay run 147. I know that was what I signed on Friday, which means that our payments are 50% of the way for this allocation, and our classes are 66% of the way. So we are 16% lagging behind. But we need to check each of the 40,000 claims as they come in. And they don't come directly to us. From the educator, they get handed to the supervisor, who has to collect his full quota of 10. And those have to be handed to a coordinator who has to collect a full quota of 20. And the courier then, when they have collected those, picks them up. If they haven't got their full quota and they're sending in later submissions, the computer won't allow that payment until there's a minimum of 80 packs per coordinator that have arrived at Pretoria. They check, they've got to be signed on the ground before we're able to pay them. So we're lagging about 16% behind. And we do have other problems. We actually have volunteers who've never received a payment. And we are tracing those now because there are bank detail problems. And also the banks simply close accounts if there isn't a regular income going into the account. We have a lot of problems with those. We also have problems with banking details, where the code might be wrong or the ID number doesn't match the ID number of the account. So those are problems that we deal with those. At the moment, we've brought it down from, it was 6,000, we got it to 4,000, and recently we started using an SMS system for people to rectify banking details, and we're down to 2,000. On Friday, I think it was 1,900, what we call rejects, money, claims coming back. So it is a complicated system. We've sent out a newspaper to our educators to explain the system. It has to be output-based, because if we have to be so careful that we're not paying to ghosts. We are trying to speed up the system for next year using a PDA system, but later when we've piloted that system, I will inform the committee of that process. I just want to respond to the other members' query on the length of time, and it has been the bane of my life. I really wish that we were able even to take it to 8 months, if we were, but each month, our stipend pay bill is 50 million. And if I had another, for example, this year, another 100 million, we could allow an extra 2 months of teaching, and it would really consolidate the learner's efforts a lot more. And so I understand the question. From our side, we just simply don't have the resources. What we do is we give 240 hours of tuition, and it's 85 lessons that the learners have to do. And we've had a reasonable success. Most of the learners are able to come through competent. In fact, in the last year, we had an 87% pass rate of our learners in the 240 hours. But we believe that an additional 2 months, an additional 4 months even, would make it, we could really then consolidate their efforts. But we've cut our implementation to the bare minimum. We're only doing it at 680 rand per learner, and of that, 75% is the stipend payment. If we had more resources, we could have a Rolls Royce. But thank you for saying it's a good program, because we believe that it is a good program.
Can I just ask you on the issue of reducing illiteracy? There's a target of reducing it by 50%. I've been at pains to try and find what is the number that we're working on. I see there's percentages in the annual report referring to percentages and so on. But have you got a figure that you have in mind? I think the year is 2015 or something of that nature. by 2015, how many people would you have had to pass through the program in numbers and not necessarily percentages, because I'm not sure how that works?
Yes, ma'am, the number of people who've never been to school, and that was based on the 2002 census, was 4.7 million. However, the other side, the other half, would comprise of people who have been to school, and we are picking up some of those people in the campaign because we test them beforehand. And a year of schooling under a tree, on a, sitting on a stone without a book, is what you're picking up, 2 years and 3 years, where that person really doesn't even, is not able to write their name. So 50% have never been to school. The other 50% have been and have had some kind of learning. But when we test them, the level is poor enough for them to gain entry into the program. Really, the first 3-4 years of schooling, that we're picking them up, and they absolutely cannot write their names. And so the target for them to meet our Education for All goal, which is a 2050 commitment that South Africa made, 2015, sorry, Matt, is to reach half of the 9.6 million people. And so we are targeting 4.5 for that period. We're going slower. We've reached our first million. If we don't have sufficient funding to increase the throughput, and yet I still believe we can make it. We could still make that goal. But the other component of people are people who are not functional. They really are not functional.
Well, yeah, just to elaborate on that, then obviously it would be an ongoing process of mopping up the other 4 million odd that would want it. But perhaps also to make the point around the 6 months, and I hear Professor Mackay's appeal for more money and more time. She's not going to get it, I'm sure, but so be it. But yeah, that's not the end of the road. This simply gives you an ABET Level 1 qualification, which, as you heard, is both tested and quality assured by SACWA. So it's not a Mickey Mouse qualification. It's a Level 1, ABET Level 1. The idea is then, from there, you move into an ABET center, where you proceed with ABET level 2, 3, and 4. So it's not meant to be the end of the road, it's simply the start of a lifelong learning process, and people should understand that. I know many people have come back and wanted to register for a second 6 months, partly just because they enjoy the program. Well, I'm afraid we don't have the luxury of money to provide for that. Madam Chair, I think that's most of the questions in this round. I don't know if there are any that we have missed.
Just on, I think the point about getting good is well taken. I think the reality is also that one, that he's possibly not, even that level 1 to level 2, somehow the people, because I think level 2 ABET centers will be province-based, level 1, what you are doing is nationally based, so there is not necessarily always a comprehensive alignment in a sense. So I think please take that one for us forward. We're not always speaking, even in the education arena, then we're not always speaking to each other in that space, and the way the DG has covered it actually helped, but it's the implementation, therefore, that's the issue there. That's the one. Secondly, the link between Garagudi and a skills, a CETA intervention. I'm not picking up there is, and possibly because of the past, the fragmented issues, and I think it will be a little bit better if training and education start to cohere. So that's the second one. And then thirdly, it's interesting for me that a volunteer educator that earns, I think, 1,200 roughly stipend, that out of that 1,200, if I'm a volunteer educator and I want to actually go into other levels of skilling, and there's money for that levels of skilling elsewhere, not necessarily from the Department of Education in its historical context, then the program managers are not able to guide me in that space. So 400 or 500 rand of my 1,200 rand that I already have invested or that I'm getting because of my intention to help others, if I want to go to any other levels of skilling, this is now not even in the program but outside, that there's not that connection. So it's something that we've picked up from our Guyana visit, and it's very real. And I suspect it's not necessarily that much in the metro areas, I suspect it's got to do with rural areas. And if you can just have a bit of a focus on that for us as well.
We'd note those. Just say the one area we are tracking people, of course, into the teaching profession. We have identified some of our Karagudi volunteers who are clearly superb teachers. They have gone under the foot of the Shark Bursaries into teacher training, but certainly much wider. Professor McCum?
In the last week, we've spoken to the ETGP CETA, and we are talking to the Extended Public Works Program, for both for skills programs for them and then also to be referred for short courses to ETGP.
Sorry, Chairperson, I just wanted to say that one of the things that we're doing with the Karagudi is now getting a database of where their sites are to match them with public adult learning centers for precisely their continuation. And I think what we also did with them was develop the ABET Level 2 materials along the same lines so that the learners don't feel the gap in terms of quality, because the reason why they go back to Karagudi was because there was different sets of materials. So the level 2 materials are exactly the same, so they continue. But I think for us in adult education, the best thing that has happened is the movement of adult education to HET and skills for the reasons that you are saying. Because we believe that adult education will be better served by different kinds of colleges, including equity colleges, especially for the skills component and the CETA. So I think the issue of integration of education and training
will be served
by that.
I know Chair Mr. Ndebele really just said that so she could hold up some of these materials, which she's rightly very proud of. I really would invite you to look at them. I'm sure you've seen the Karagudi materials already and superb. They have now worked with the ABET section in producing this continued series, and really they're wonderful materials. So thank you, Mr. Ndebele. We've noted them.
Do we understand this correctly, that ABET, in any case, notwithstanding what you were saying now, ABET still stays with basic education, or does that move?
What we're looking at is that ABET, in a sense, in the form of Karagudi initial literacy, will stay with basic education, but what we're calling adult education and training now will become more skills-oriented. And
so from level 2 onwards?
Yeah, I'm not sure we've drawn such a sharp line, but it would be about the basics and when you then graduate from that into more of a skills program.
Chairperson, it's difficult to respond because part of the review is to also to get rid of the ABET levels, because they have contributed to keeping adults in one place. So it's taken them longer to get a GET than it would have taken them for them to go to school. So part of the review is to make sure that we collapse the level so that they move faster and they've got access to skills programs, because the level doesn't really make sense.
Well, good luck with that debate. I'm going to just we've run out of time for this session. We will continue tomorrow, but let me just finish this issue of skills development by asking around the Dina Lady School. I see that one of the things that you've reported is that the number of schools have been increased 500 in 2008. Can I just find out? We had Uma Lucy here not so long ago, last week I think it was. And let me ask you this question first as a precursor. Dina Lady schools, are they at primary or high school level? At high school level. We noted an interesting discrepancy around paper 3. The math paper 3 in particular. Dina Lady, as I understand, is a special focus school intended to increase the quality, shall we say, of math, particular and science learnership at those schools. We were told, though, that only, what was it, around, can't remember the figure, but it was like a really low figure. It was more like 30,000 or something like that out of 400,000 who would write paper 3 at that level. Now, paper 3, it seems to me to be where the problems with HESA and these other people are now cropping up. What is the thinking on that issue? Because I would have thought that given the amount of resources and the backup that is provided to Dina Lady schools, that those learners
should be taking math at level 3. Is that the plan? Is it not the plan? Why is it that we're having such a low number of students writing paper 3 at that level?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think an important question. I think Mr. Matui is well placed to respond to it, if I may.
Thank you, DG. Thank you, Chairperson. The issue of paper 3 predates the implementation of the writing process of the national curriculum when we moved away from higher grades to standard grades. And one of the things that the mathematics community had said at that point was to begin to consider aspects and sections that had to be included both in paper 1 and paper 2 of mathematics. There has been a school of thought in respect of paper 3 that began to say there's an aspect that is referred to as Euclidean geometry that is so fundamental in the particularly for those learners that will take engineering courses and so on. And what we have put on the table is that there will be a process that begins to review that as a means of potentially considering including Euclidean geometry in paper 2, and that is the case. As it currently stands, as current policy currently stands, paper 3 is actually an optional paper, and that is why the number of learners that have been that have taken the paper 3 at that particular level. However, as it relates to the Dinaledi schools, Chairperson, there are over 200 Dinaledi schools that already offer paper 3. However, it is not all learners that would have taken paper 3 as a subject. Plans that are currently in place is that we have identified those schools. We have also sought to ensure that consistent with introducing paper 3 would be an aspect of teacher training, because part of an analysis of the previous process has been that many teachers have struggled with that aspect of that is of those topics that are included in paper 3. And the view is to ensure that as we expand on paper 3, we then lift up the aspect of teacher training. And as we speak, there are plans to even begin to introduce paper 3 in many of the Dinaledi schools in grade 10 in 2010, with a view to ensure that by 2012 we would have a greater cohort of learners coming out of this.
Look, maybe it's because we don't have enough time here, and maybe I'm misunderstanding the situation. But as I understand in our lady school, these are teachers who are qualified teachers who know the content and so on and can teach the content. That's the whole point of Nina Lady, as far as I understand it. The question ultimately has to be why it is that paper 3 becomes an option in those schools and not made compulsory, given the amount of resources you put into the project and given what they meant to achieve. So obviously, if you're going to make it an option, it's human nature. I mean, if I was given an option whether to do something difficult and not to let it count as part of my marks, I wouldn't do it. And wouldn't have nothing to do with whether I was capable of doing it or not capable of doing it. That's not the point. If you don't make it compulsory, then it doesn't count. Nobody is going to exert themselves, particularly not at matric when the stakes are so high, really. So it's a matter we will debate further with you, but I do think, you know, if we have these priorities, and we do, we're saying that we want to increase the number of math and science students and so on who graduate into those scarce skills at higher education. If we have those priorities, then certainly we need to feed into those priorities. So we'll take that issue up with you a little more saliently, hopefully in the next few weeks, and maybe we'll have special sessions with you. But one of the things that we are going to hopefully do next week already is to visit Umalusi and look from their perspective on some of these issues. I know that they've done an audit of the standards of the various papers and so on, and we want to share ourselves with those outcomes first and then engage with you on this issue. But let me just say, and somebody has their hands up. Is it you, Ms. Pochan? Okay, hang on. I'm going to give you an opportunity in a second, but please make it brief, bearing in mind that tomorrow we're continuing with the session, and so you'll have more opportunities. So if it can't wait till tomorrow, you have the floor quickly. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Porchani. Thank you all. We'll see you bright and early tomorrow. What time? 4:75. 9:30, and then you'll have a chair in the form of Mario Franklin, who will then ignore my hand.
Chair, will you have a chance to present the financial report then at that stage?
Yes, you will. Sorry, we're going through the presentation and then clearly we'll go through the financial report as well. Thank you.
Chair, at the left table.
It's a recording. It's a recording.